You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
The U.S. intelligence community says that China is actively trying to recruit spies over LinkedIn. The Windshift Espionage Group is active in the Gulf. Global imposter ransomware continues its evolution and spread. The Five Eyes issues some communiques about cooperation in cyberspace. Russia would like to block Telegram if it could do so without too much collateral traffic damage. And supply chain questions about Google's Titan. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, August 31st, 2018. Senior U.S. counterintelligence official William Evanina, whose formal title is Director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, warned that Chinese intelligence services are actively using LinkedIn to recruit American agents. The Chinese recruiting campaign involves contacting thousands of LinkedIn members at a time. The effort apparently involves catfishing. Director Evanina declined to disclose how many bogus Chinese accounts U.S. authorities had discovered. He also wouldn't say how many Americans had been contacted or with what success. Evanina recommended that LinkedIn take action to purge itself of inauthentic accounts, pointing to Twitter's recent house cleaning as a good model for LinkedIn to consider. He was clear in that he regarded LinkedIn as a victim in this case. LinkedIn told Reuters that they've been talking with U.S. law enforcement agencies about Chinese espionage and that they did what they could to control catfishing and other abuse. The company's head of trust and safety, Paul Rockwell, said, quote, "We've never waited for requests to act and actively identify bad actors and remove bad accounts using information we uncover and intelligence from a variety of sources, including government agencies," end quote. Evanina's warning was motivated by the June conviction of Kevin Mallory, a retired CIA officer, on charges of conspiracy to commit espionage. A Mandarin speaker, Mallory found himself financially pinched in retirement. He was contacted over LinkedIn by an individual using the name Richard Yang, who represented himself as a headhunter. Yang arranged a contact between Mallory and a third man who said he worked for a Shanghai think tank. Mallory made two trips to Shanghai, during which he agreed to sell defense secrets to his Chinese contacts. Mallory, who the U.S. government thinks probably knew full well what he was getting into, will be sentenced in September and might get life. But hey, doesn't everybody recruit over LinkedIn? It's worth noting that this kind of recruiting can look initially legitimate. It's not as though you'll get a direct message inviting you to connect because, hey, you look like you might have treasonous skills. Nor are foreign intelligence services scouring LinkedIn for profiles of people who describe themselves as driven professionals with a passion for betraying their country, reasonable compensation to be determined in negotiation. No, the recruiters seek to connect, elicit a response, habituate you to talking with them, then to doing small favors or good offices, and before you know it, you've moved from advising someone on your common hobby of stamp collecting to handing over plans for an F-35 radar. Maybe the contact is someone you've never met, or maybe it's a friend of an acquaintance, or maybe it's someone you vaguely remember swapping cards with at that busy rootin'-tootin' cyber-shootin' happy hour just outside Fort Gordon. You remember, don't you? They had a bull ride in the barroom and everything. By the way, if you've ever tried to connect with our editor and he hasn't responded, it's probably because he thinks you're some kind of intelligence officer. That kind of suspicion, it's like a sickness with him. He doesn't mean to be rude. A hacking crew called Windshift is exploiting macOS vulnerabilities in an espionage campaign directed against the Gulf Cooperation Council. That's Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman. The malware payload is distributed in spear phishing attacks. They promise more details later. There's no further attribution from Dark Matter, the security company that announced the discovery. As difficult as it may be to look at that target list and not think of that regional rival in the Gulf Cooperation Council, the one with the capital in Tehran, it's important, as always, to remember that many, most all, nations spy, and that there are many services who'd be interested in the Gulf. Kihu 360 warns that Global Imposter ransomware is now out in more than 20 variants, and they expect it to continue to evolve and spread. The researchers consider it the most troubling family of ransomware currently in circulation. Russia would like to block the Telegram encrypted messaging service, but their attempts have been unsuccessful. They haven't yet come up with a way of stopping Telegram without also stopping a lot of other traffic, and that's unacceptable collateral damage. The Five Eyes, as the intelligence services of the U.S., U.K., Australia, Canada, and New Zealand are called, in recognition of roughly a century of close cooperation, agreed this week to increase collaboration in cyberspace. The official communique covered much familiar ground: determination to work against terrorism, cooperation on law enforcement, border security, with an emphasis on fighting human trafficking, a shared commitment to a safe and open internet, determination to protect children, and so on. 4 points are worth particular mention. First, the five governments expressed a common determination to share intelligence and resources to thwart foreign influence operations. Second, the governments say their talks this year have focused on tangible deliverables and practical collaboration. Third, they regret that industry declined their invitation to participate in the discussion because none of this will work without industry help. And finally, they're not going to give up the crypto wars. They remain concerned that end-to-end encryption makes it too easy for criminals and terrorists to operate with impunity. The discussions produced a joint statement of principles on access to evidence and encryption. One concession to the pro-encryption side: governments should recognize that the nature of encryption is such that there will be situations where access to information is not possible, although such situations should be rare. Google's Titan security key, introduced recently with pride and aplomb, is manufactured in China, which has already prompted SpoilSports to spit in the soup by asking for some transparency about supply chain security. Come on, guys, lighten up. We're pretty sure someone we connected with on LinkedIn told us those supply chains in China are great. Just aces. Monday is Labor Day here in the U.S., and we'll be observing the federal holiday by taking the day off, probably to hit the Maryland State Fair up in Timonium. We'll resume normal publication and podcasting on Tuesday. Of course, Research Saturday will be up as usual tomorrow, as will the week that was. It's just Monday we're taking off. Take a breather if you can, and we'll see you next week.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And joining me once again is Johannes Ulrich. He's from the SANS Institute. He's also the host of the ISC Stormcast podcast. Johannes, welcome back. We have seen a lot of stories coming by about iPhone security and how Apple has sort of been upping their game when it comes to some of the protections when it comes to the iPhone, doing time limits and so forth. But you wanted to share some news about how thieves are still managing to unlock iPhones. So what do you have to share today?
Yeah, what you mentioned is really, when law enforcement tries to access a locked iPhone, they sometimes have access to these Kraylock devices, or what they're called. They essentially brute force the pin that you use to lock the device. So best practice, you lock your device with a pin code. But thieves go a little bit differently about unlocking iPhones. They have a couple of neat sort of social engineering tricks that they tend to use. Now, one trick, for example, is your iPhone, it has a removable SIM card. This SIM card can be plugged into another phone. Typically, that other phone now takes on the identity of your iPhone. So that phone, which is owned by the thief, it's of course not locked, and it will now receive, for example, text messages that are used for password reset in some cases. And the attacker also now knows your phone number, which can be helpful for sort of other tricks that they're playing, like social engineering tricks. Often when your iPhone is lost or stolen, you will now, for example, set up the iPhone in locked mode, which basically alerts you whenever it is being found. What attackers are doing now is they'll send you a fake message that appears to come from Apple that tells you, hey, your phone was found. Click here to display the location. Imagine what happens next. You click on the link and you end up on a phishing site. So now the attacker is able to get the username and password for your iCloud account. And with that, they may be able to turn off this lock on the phone and reset it. In some cases, they may also just call you. If you display, for example, a phone number on the iPhone, and you can do that when you mark it as lost or stolen, they'll call you and they say, hey, we found your phone. And but we want to send it back to you, but we first have to know that it's actually your phone. And then they trick you into unlocking the phone in order to do this verification. So a lot of social engineering happening here. Now, there are a couple things that you can do to protect yourself. First of all, and that's a feature that's not often used, you can protect your SIM card with a PIN code. What happens is when the iPhone is turned off and you turn it back on, before the SIM card can be used, you have to enter a 4-digit PIN code. You can do this in your cell network settings within the iPhone, and that protects yourself from someone removing the SIM card and plugging it into another phone. And the second thing that you definitely should do is enable two-factor authentication to prevent some of these phishing attacks.
All right. Well, it's good information. Johannes Ulrich, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire Daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
It's my pleasure to welcome back to the CyberWire, Wired senior writer Andy Greenberg. He's author of the recent Wired article, The Untold Story of NotPetya, the most devastating cyber attack in history.
NotPetya was this piece of malware that exploded across the internet in June 26th of 2017. And it at first seemed like it was a ransomware worm like WannaCry, which had happened just a couple of months earlier. But then it turned out that there was no way to pay the ransom. It was simply a wiper disguised as ransomware. It was just encrypting computers irreparably. And it targeted Ukraine, but spread across the world. And it used, I would say, three components to achieve a really virulent spread. It first used this backdoor in this Ukrainian accounting software called EmiDoc that essentially allowed NotPetya's creators a foothold onto any machine that was running this kind of Ukrainian TurboTax or Quicken software. Anyone who was doing business in Ukraine basically had this software. And then within a network that was running that software on even just one machine, it could spread by two kind of intertwined techniques. One was an adapted version of Mimikatz, the tool that can basically pull plain text passwords out of a Windows machine's memory and use those to log into any other machine that uses those credentials. And then the other one was the leaked NSA hacking tool, Eternal Blue, which had been patched, but still there was a patch available, but it still hadn't been patched to all the machines. So NotPetya would use that to break into unpatched machines. And then when a machine was patched, it could sometimes still get access with Mimikatz. And so with this kind of hopscotching technique of one exploit over the other one, it could spread to thousands of computers within a multinational company's network in seconds sometimes. And it turned out to just be a devastating attack and spread to companies like Maersk and Merck and FedEx and the French construction company Saint-Gobain and the food producer Mondelez and just a long list of huge companies, inflicting hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to each one, and turned out to be the most expensive malware attack in history.
Now, your article digs into the situation at Maersk in detail. And one of the things that strikes me about this is that this crosses over the cyber domain. We're talking about real things, real products that have to be shipped around the world.
Right. The book I'm working on is about this hacker group Sandworm, and this seems to be their specialty, is that they inflict damage that does cross that line. They were responsible for the blackout attacks in Ukraine, for instance, and they deployed NotPetya too. And NotPetya did inflict this kind of physical paralysis as well, mostly by virtue of the companies that it hit. And Maersk is the best example of that. I mean, 17 of Maersk's 76 terminals and ports around the world were completely shut down by this, with thousands and thousands of trucks just lining up outside of the gates of those ports, unable to check in. It was crippling of a big part of the global logistics supply chain.
Now, one of the conclusions I think that there's general agreement on is that this was sourced from the Russians, targeting Ukrainians. But I think there's a lot of speculation and disagreement over whether it was intended to get out beyond that, whether it was intended to get out in the wild. And that's something that you touch on in this article.
Well, computer worms spread by their very nature, and that means they often spread out of control, or almost always spread out of control, it seems like. in this case, it took literally, minutes for NotPetya, it seems like, to spread beyond its intended target of Ukraine to all of these multinational companies that just had sometimes, an office in Ukraine or a couple of computers even in Ukraine was all it took for one of those machines running this accounting software just to become the patient zero for their infection. Whether that was an accident is still up for debate. You know, the very least we can say that it was insanely reckless of the Russian state to launch this piece of malware that had no controls, that had no way of trying to determine if it was in Ukraine or not before causing all this destruction. Craig Williams at Cisco Talos made the argument to me that it wasn't an accident that it hit all of these multinationals, that in fact, it was trying to send a message to them too, don't do business in Ukraine. This is our enemy, stay away. In fact, I've heard before that one of Russia's goals with its ongoing cyber war in Ukraine, and this is really a multi-year thing now, is to scare away investments and partnerships and to make Ukraine look like a dangerous failed state that you don't want to do business in. And I think that this had that effect, whether it was intended or not. I do think that multinationals are going to approach Ukraine differently when they know that it's essentially a war zone and that they could be collateral damage if they even, put a foot into it.
What was the response from the rest of the world in terms of policy? How did people come down on Russia? Was there punishment?
Not initially, and maybe never enough. It took 8 months for the U.S. to institute sanctions in response to this, and it took nearly that long for really all of the Five Eyes to publicly state that this was Russia's, Russia behind this. The fact that there were sanctions is, I think that that's totally the right move, but 8 months is quite a long time. And then not long after those sanctions were pushed through, and it seems like the real proponents of that within the Trump White House were Rob Joyce and Tom Bossert, really the two most senior cyber officials. Both of them left very mysteriously from the White House, and I have not yet gotten a good answer about why. We know that Trump has a very complicated story, notoriously, about responding to Russia, or is he soft on Russia? Is he willing to hold Russian hackers to account? It seems like in this case, a couple of his officials were, but then they were very quickly pushed out, from what I can tell. So that doesn't send the right message to Putin either. I think it's encouraging that there were sanctions. It wasn't as unified a message as it could have been. Will it deter the next one of these? It's hard to say. I mean, there were even sanctions against Russia for its election interference as well. And it seems like that has continued in certain ways, certainly around the world. And it is hard to put Putin in a box. It seems like he resists all forms of deterrence. So I don't know if it's enough.
Yeah, it strikes me that, and I don't want to overstate it here or use hyperbole, but it reminds me a little bit of biological warfare in the way that this sort of thing can spread and reach beyond intended targets. And I can't help wondering if we need to head towards some sort of international norm where this kind of attack from a nation state is prohibited and nations around the world agree on that.
I think that does sound like the right answer. I mean, we talk about discussions of whether attacks on critical infrastructure are okay, and then sometimes it sounds like they're okay in wartime. This was a wartime attack, but in this medium of the internet, attacks from one nation against another don't stay in that nation. So that's what happened here, is that this was like a nation against nation attack that became a global epidemic immediately. And that is a dangerous, new, and I think poorly understood phenomenon. And the answer may be that we have to set rules about infectious, virulent attacks like this and just say that they're off limits, as you say, in the same way as biological warfare is. I mean, I think that treating this sort of thing and attacks on critical infrastructure by hackers as a kind of war crime seems like part of the larger solution.
That's Andy Greenberg, senior writer at Wired. He's the author of The Untold Story of NotPetya, the most devastating cyber attack in history. His forthcoming book is titled Sandworm, A New Era of Cyber War and the Hunt for the Kremlin's Most Dangerous Hackers. We'll see that book's release next year. There's an extended version of my interview with Andy Greenberg over on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/thecyberwire. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.